evening, you guys. At this time, we run the TechNet. This will be TechNet number 1709 of the series that began in September of 1982. You guys have heard me say so often, the main purpose of the TechNet is education. The curious radio amateurs gather at this time and teach each other the inner secrets of the wireless technology. The books and the courses only partially cover the subject. You really want somebody who understands radio equipment, you got to hire a ham radio operator. The TechNet is broken up into three sections. The first section, people sign in with their questions and comments. Second section, Roy, AC2GS, gives us the science talk. And the third section, Paul, WS2N, gives us the space report. And each of these sections are sometimes extended or shrunken, depending on how much material, how much enthusiasm, and so on. We don't believe in great regimentation here. On top of that, don't worry about the question you're about to ask. There is no such thing as a dumb question on the TechNet. We don't have that attitude. The question that sounds like a dumb question really represents the biggest difference between what the guy knows and what he wants to know. Therefore, he's most deserving of an answer. So we don't worry about the snootiness, so to speak. A person signs into the TechNet by giving us your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a comment or a question for the net. Need not sign in because you're listening. After 36 years of TechNet, we believe somebody is listening. That doesn't have to be proven anymore. So, if you have a question or a comment, please sign in right now. Try to remember to wait for the four beeps in between each transmission, otherwise we get a timeout problem. K2RIW listening for check-ins. Okay. Somebody started to sign in, but didn't wait long enough. I only heard the last syllable of the last word. Want to try to sign in again, sir?
KD2DKA. The name is Jay. And yes, I have a question.
Okay, Jay. PKA, is that the Papa Kilo Alpha?
Yes. Papa Kilo Alpha.
We got you, Jay. All's well. Yeah, sometimes, depending on how a person is signed in by Echolink or IRLP, or their particular repeater. Sometimes there's a second or two delay before the whole machine system picks up. So when in doubt, squeeze the push the talk button, wait a second, and then start giving us the information. I got Jay as a sign in so far. Who's the next person who's going to sign into the TechNet with a question or a comment? Please give your name and call letters right now. K2RIW. Hey, Jay, maybe we're only going to get one person to sign in tonight. Hope you got a nice long question to fill up the time. One last call. Anyone to check in with questions or comments for the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name right now.
KB2PTF, a question about hotspots.
Okay, it sounded like Kilo Delta 2, Papa, Papa, Mike. Please correct me on the call letters, and please tell us your name, sir. K2RIW.
Hey, the name is Matt. It's Kilo Delta 2, Papa, Papa, Foxtrot, Neurochelle, New York. Yeah, it's a question about some hotspots. I'm going to switch radios here.
Okay, Papa, Papa, Foxtrot, we got you, Matt. And one last call. For someone to sign into the TechNet, please give me your call letters and name. Right now, K2RIW listening. And maybe we're going to have a late night tonight. Jay, it's time for you to start. KD2, Papa, Kilo, Alpha. Go right ahead with your question or comment. You've got it, Jay.
Okay, thank you. I was just wondering, I have a radio and it has two fuses. It's got one on the negative and one on the positive. And I was just wondering why we need one on the negative side.
Yeah, Jay, you picked up without waiting for the beeps, but you had a brief enough transmission, no problem. That's a darn good question. I am guessing some manufacturers put a fuse on both sides just to be double darn sure. Because in the old days, occasionally, you had a positive grounded radio system in a car. Some cars in the old days did have the positive lead grounded and the negative lead was the hot one. So in that case, you'd need a fuse on the negative side. And I guess there's various techniques by which some portion of the ham radio equipment, the antenna transmission line, cable, or whatever, can touch something with a positive voltage on it. And it would try to raise the whole chassis above ground. And you would get some ridiculous current drain on the so-called negative lead of the radio if there wasn't a fuse on it. So it's a double darn sure. Most of the time, I think it's not needed. But as long as the fuse is in good working condition, I don't think it creates any problem. That's a bunch of guesses on my part. For the guys who are a little bit more informed on this one, why is there a fuse on the negative lead of some radios? If you got any information on that, please give us your call letters right now. T2RIW in the TechNet.
WS2N.
Go right ahead, Paul.
I remember discussing this a long time ago, many years ago, but I believe it was if the positive line, positive lead, or anything that was positive got loose in that engine when somebody was working on it and somehow got across to the negative side without that negative side being there, you know, you could actually create damage to, you know, to the battery or the car itself. Something along those lines. If another line or something got loose and got to that negative side, you're better off having a fuse on the negative side as well. I think that was one of the cases. There was another case too. It was something to do with protecting the radio if something unusual happened. Don't remember, but pretty sure about that one.
Yeah, there are some freak accidents that can occur by which a very large current might try to flow from the negative lead of the battery through the negative lead of the power supply wiring to the radio. And if a very large current flows through that negative lead without it being fused, the wire itself could create a meltdown condition, and that could be avoided by way of a fuse. To be safest possible, the fuse should be right at the battery itself. And I think in most of our radios that have a fuse on the positive and negative lead, the fuse is much closer to the radio on the firewall side of the car, on the passenger side of the firewall. But right at the battery may be the safest place. So there, I'm not sure. So if we have any further information as to why there is a fuse on the negative lead on the B-plus wiring of some radios for automobile use, give us your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet. And there are various ways that the fuse and fuse holder can fail. After a time, some fuses will develop some extra resistance and excessive voltage drop across them, which can be a little bit troublesome. Quite a few automobile-type radios, by that I mean mobile radios, work beautifully when the car is running and the alternator plus battery is cranking out 13.7 volts, let's say, 13.4, some number like that, and the radio is very happy. Turn off the motor, run purely on the battery, and the battery might go down to 12.2 volts. By the time the voltage drop in your wiring takes place and your radio is down to 11.8, some radios at 11.8 behave rather poorly. My Kenwood 751 is one of those where in the sideband mode it gives me dropouts at anything less than, let's say, 12.2 volts or so at the actual radio. So the voltage drops through the fuses. A fuse has to have a little bit of a voltage drop, otherwise it's not going to work. And so that can be troublesome. So fuses as they age, sometimes they develop some extra resistance. So even though the fuse hasn't blown, occasionally you want to replace it or double check you're getting very good contacts in the way the fuse plugs into its fuse holder. K2IZW listening.
Yes, I was thinking about these things also, but with the fuse in there years ago, there used to be all metal chassis in the car. And then maybe, you know, I was wondering, you know, and that would cause another ground. So you would ground your car when you mounted the radio in the car. But now, everything seems to be made out of plastic. And I don't know if it would make a good ground. So that's why I was wondering about that.
Yeah, you bring up a good point there, Jay, and that is with the radio no longer metallically being grounded because almost everything is plastic, if by some means the shield of the coax cable going to the antenna came in contact with something that's got 12 volts on it, the whole chassis of your radio would be up at plus 12 volts. And without that fuse on the negative lead, a tremendous amount of current would flow through that negative lead back to the battery, which could create a fire hazard, a meltdown, and so on. So, with the radio being mysteriously grounded because of plastic, I think the fuse on the negative lead is a good thing to have. I'll pass it back to Jay for any final comments, and if anyone else has got any more information, please give us your call letters right now, K2IW and the TechNet.
WA2CBL.
Tell us about this one, Andy. Go right ahead.
Good evening, everybody. There's a lead from the battery that goes to the starter. That's usually the positive lead. There's a lead from the negative of the battery that goes to the engine, and it usually has a pigtail that goes to the chassis, a very light pigtail going to maybe an inner fender. If there was corrosion on the mounting of the lugs from the negative battery terminal to the engine, you're going to have a lot of stray paths from the starter looking to get back to negative, and it quite possible can use that lead from the, and that's a good idea for having the fuse in there. Over.
Yeah, who's the person who just made that transmission? K2RIW, please give us your call out as a name.
K2GJE.
Okay, Mr. GJE. You made it sound like the negative lead of the battery is only a light gauge wire going to ground. I'm having trouble with that because that heavy braid that goes to the starter motor has to be able to tolerate, let me pick a number, almost 100 or so amperes. And if the only thing that completes the circuit is that light lead from the negative lead of the battery to the chassis, you would burn that one up immediately. So how do you get the right current to the starter motor if the negative lead of the battery is only lightly grounded? Mr. GJE, K2RIW, go ahead.
Usually two leads on a negative. A heavy one going to the engine with a bolt and a flat washer and a lock washer, I hope, and a light lead going to chassis. If that heavy lead would have corrosion at the engine block, and I had that happen while I wasn't charging because of that, it's going to seek other paths from that 300 amps that the starter wants to see. Over.
Okay, so you've got a heavy lead from the battery to the engine block, and I guess because of the rubber mounts and whatever, to some degree, the engine block could be floating from the rest of the chassis. Is that sort of what you're saying?
Really, it is. You see a lot of braids here and there because the computer itself can't tolerate noise. But that heavy lead coming off the negative going to the engine block is on with one bolt in an area where there's a lot of heat, there's a lot of grease, there's a lot of corrosion. And if there's any trouble there, it's going to seek other paths, and that might be a radio negative lead. Over.
So if I understand you correctly, Ed, you're happy that the well-made radios have a fuse on the negative lead to the radio. Is that what you're saying?
Over.
You said over. I'm not quite sure what that means. Once again, Ed.
I maybe didn't hold it down fast enough. Yes, I'm very happy. There's a heavy lead coming off the battery to the negative and the positive, but they are subject to corrosion. And I had a problem where everything looked right. The engine started right, but the alternator was not able to charge the battery. Over.
Okay, I see the problem. Now, 2 minutes ago, 3 minutes ago, we tried to turn it over to Andy, to B2CDL. Try again, Andy. Go right ahead and take your chance. Hit your turn.
Okay, Dick, W-A-T-C-D-L. Can you hear me okay?
Hearing you fine. Heard you fine before.
Okay. Yeah, basically what Ed said is what is the reason. What I've heard, and actually what I read in some of the Kenwood manuals of doing repairs, is they do put a fuse in a negative lead for a safety reason. And the safety is that if the ground wire from the battery to the car frame fails, then the radio ground becomes the ground for the return path for the battery to the vehicle. It then goes to the radio, and of course it can't handle that current, so it'll burn up. And to prevent that from happening, they put a fuse in the negative lead. And that's mainly the reason. I mean, there is no other reason to have a fuse on the negative side, but that's the reason, especially the fact that some of the newer radios are isolated, have isolated grounds. In other words, the negative lead of the radio is not the common ground or chassis ground of the radio. It's isolated. So, and that's another factor. So basically, that's the reason that I've seen, and that makes sense. Back to you.
So if I understand you correctly, the negative lead supplying power to a mobile radio goes through a grommet of some kind into the radio, runs that circuitry in there, but doesn't necessarily connect to the chassis of the radio. And so the only real grounding then would be the output TL-259, SO-239 connector that feeds the coax cable. And that would be the RF output, which might be DC isolated from the actual power supply. Do I think you're saying? That suggests you've got some kind of transformer-like device on the final stage of the RF circuit of the radio that feeds that coax cable. Over to you, Andy, K2RIW.
All right. I just paused for the ID. Yeah, I've seen where the ground wire, the black ground wire was open completely. And the return ground, the ground return, I should say, is going through the TL-259 through the coax to the antenna. That's what's providing the ground for the radio. And without that, the radio won't turn on because there's no ground return. There's no ground path. That's not in all cases. It's in some radios, not all. I don't remember which ones have that situation, which ones don't. But in some cases, it is isolated. But you don't, again, you don't want the heavy ground. If it opens up from the battery to the chassis, to be substituted by the radio's ground, and that could cause a problem, obviously. So that's the reason. All right, back to you, Dick, W-8-CDL.
Okay, I thank you for Ed, Andy, anyone else that wants to contribute to this one. Back to you, Jay, for any final comments. So, by the way, one quick question, Andy. When you do have a fuse on the negative lead, where do you believe is the most desirable place for that fuse to be located? Should it be a few inches away from the negative lead of the battery? Or should that fuse, the negative lead fuse, be a few inches away from the radio itself at the other end of that long black wire? W-A-2-CDL, K2-RIW.
Yeah, that's an interesting question because normally the power cords, as an example, that Kenwood supplies have two fuses in the power cable. The red lead, one fuse in the red lead, one fuse in the black lead, and they're in the same location. If you extended the power lead outward and see where the fuses are located, they'll be in the exact same spot along the line length of the power cord, of the power cable going to it. I don't remember exactly where it's located, but they're in the same spot. And they are closer to the entrance point where you connect it to the power source. Not at the radio end, it's at the opposite end, but where exactly, it could vary. A foot or so, maybe less. Back to you.
Yep, I've seen that, particularly on Kenwood's, their power cords. So, any further questions or comments, H.A. KD2, Papa Victor Alpha, KD2RIW in the TechNet?
Yes, I just wanted to see, because I heard that somebody that plugged their radio into a cigarette lighter plug, the radio seemed to burn out. And I don't know if they had the fuses connected or whatever. I know there's a 20-amp fuse on the cigarette lighter plug, DC plug. But I didn't know, I wasn't sure why their radio would burn out, because I have a Yaesu radio, and it has the two fuses on it. It says to connect it close to the battery, the two fuses. But I'd have to, you know, get it through a hole in the car in order to do that. And I just didn't want to burn up a radio by trying to use maybe the cigarette lighter plug to plug the radio in, so I don't have to drill a plug.
Yeah, I think it's almost never recommended to run a mobile radio from the cigarette lighter. Some of us have done it in a pinch temporarily, but it's far from the recommended way of doing it. You're saying each time he ran the radio from the cigarette lighter, you said it burned up the radio. Can you give me a few more words on that one, Jay? What really happened? And Jay, when I pass it back to you, wait for the beeps before you pick up. KQIW.
I just heard that happened to somebody. It didn't happen to me, but I usually just run it to the battery, you know, and do it that way. But I wasn't really sure if just running it into a car temporarily, it would make a difference.
Have you ever heard of that before, Andy? Can you think of any means by which a radio would suffer, other than excessive voltage drop, would suffer damage because you're running it from a cigarette lighter? W2CDL for any comments, K2RIW.
Not really, unless there's something, some power surge going on with the cigarette lighter. Usually the cigarette lighter is on its own separate fuse, because the cigarette lighter itself draws quite a bit of current, and I think they use a 20-amp fuse, automotive fuse, if I'm not mistaken, as opposed to normal 15 or 10-amp fuses. So it's rated for a higher current, but don't know the reason. I know there's, on some radios, some of the Radio Shack radios, especially the 10-meter ones, they do have a diode protection, either in series. So if you reverse the polarity, you're not going to burn anything out, because you're going through the diode in the reverse direction that's in series with the power lead. Or, in some cases, they put the diode across the power lead, so if you reverse the if you reverse the polarity, hopefully there's a fuse in the line and the fuse will blow, protecting the radio. There's two different ways of doing it, and I've seen both ways. But that's what I've seen in the past. Back to you.
Kilo 2, Kilo Echo Victor, K2KUV, Kevin here.
Go right ahead, Kevin. Wait for the beeps and you got it.
All right, guys, this was in Andy. I'm not normally on the radio at this time, but interesting stuff. With the diode, though, I think that diode protection, Andy, maybe you could elaborate a little bit, or whoever else is in. You're going to still pop a diode, though, right? I see the protection. But that will blow. Correct me if I'm wrong. I guess we'll just put it out there. I'll go back to you, Dick.
In some cases, the diode, if it's a heavy enough rated diode, protects you from reverse polarity because it's going from positive to negative inside the radio, and it forces the fuse to blow. But I guess I've seen cases where the diode itself becomes a short circuit. I bet you've repaired some of those, Andy. The B2CDL, K2IW.
Yes, I actually have one with a shorted diode as we speak. By the way, there's somebody trying to get in at the same time Kevin was talking. Just to let you know, I think he was coming on echoing. But sometimes they put the diode in series. So if you reverse the polarity by mistake, the diode is now reverse biased and the radio will not go on. So it could detect the radio that way. But that's rare. I usually see the diode across the positive and negative leads with a series fuse. With a fuse in series here on the positive side. All right, back to you. And take a pause. I think somebody is trying to get in.
Okay, the person coming in by IRLP or EchoLink, go right ahead right now. K2RIW.
IRLP is EchoLink. It's Victor. You're with me, Toronto.
Okay, there was some dropouts there, and I heard the word Toronto. So please give us your full call and name, and go right ahead. K2RIW. We're standing by waiting for the Toronto station, so go right ahead, Toronto.
AC2GS.
Go right ahead, Roy.
That was ZE3JIW Jim in Toronto. He tried a bunch of times to key in through the EchoLink, and then he got bounced out of EchoLink. So he's not showing up. I guess he'll log back on.
I thank you. Are you there, Jim? Give it another try. V3JIW, K2RIW on the TechNet.
I'm logged into EchoLink right now, so he may log back into it, or he may use RLP if that's accessible. But right now, I don't think he's going to come back to us.
And I think you're saying right now he's probably not even hearing us because he's not logged in. Is that true, Roy?
Yes, unless he has some other source, he can't hear us and he can't talk to us until he logs back on to EchoLink.
Okay, we'll wait for Jim to come back later. We'll go over to Matt right now. KD2, Papa Papa Foxtrot. K2RIW, wait for the beeps, and you got it, Matt. Matt, are you still with us? KD2PPF, K2RIW. Okay. One more call for anyone who has any further questions or comments for the TechNet. Give me a call letters right now. And name, K2RIW listening.
KD2KNH, Charlie, comment.
Sounded like Kilo Delta 2, Kilo November Hotel. If I got you right, Charlie, go right ahead.
Thank you, Dick. I just want to make a comment concerning cigarette lighter use. Remember, today they no longer print their accessory ports, and they may only be wired and fused for about 6 amps, not 20 amps.
And very few of our mobile.
3JIW back.
And very few of our radios draw only 6 amps. Hey, Jim, glad to hear you back. VE3JIW, go right ahead. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Yes, so anyway, the cigarette lighter plug, pre-2820, pre-D-Star ICOM, I was on high power, which I shouldn't have been, long-winded, and I suddenly smelt the smoke of the 2-meter amplifier going up in smoke. I've seen a lot of cars. The wires are really thin to the lighter plug. They may be heavily fused, but the wires are thin. I haven't tested, but I believe that when you start running low voltage into a radio, it has, the amplifier has the potential of drawing actually more current as it tries to work. So I think I caused the ICOM to go up in smoke by not feeding it proper power. 8800, several years with the same antenna setup, I just didn't use it on high power. So it was not an antenna problem. I did use an analyzer on the antenna after the event, and the antenna was healthy. Back to net, the cigarette lighter plugs are, to me, I'll just say, are very thin wire, like 20 gauge in the dash of most cars I've seen. But thanks for being there to do the net from Toronto, VE2RIW, VE3JIW, Toronto.
Yeah, almost all of us will say that using the cigarette lighter to power a mobile radio is a hard way to go. And there's a lot of disadvantages. If that cigarette lighter plug only has 20 gauge wiring, I'm amazed that they can get enough current through that to run the cigarette lighter itself, because it is a the heater of the cigarette lighter needs to draw an awful lot of current to become glowing hot. I'm amazed they can get enough current through a piece of 20 gauge wire to do that. Back to you for any comments on that one, Jim. VE3JIW, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Well, I have pulled a number of wires on different vehicles out, and I was astounded at the gauge of the wire on most of them. I think only was my GM ban of heavier wire, but they're relying on the wire to be run for a short length of time and the wire to get quite warm. And I don't think they really mind whether they're getting 14 volts or 8 volts to the actual element. But in general, of the number I've looked at, all of them had really thin wire. Back to net.
K2KEV with a comment.
Thank you, Jim. Mr. KEV, go right ahead, Kevin.
Well, dare I say, I'm going to keep this short. I might be breaking up.
You're sounding good, so go right ahead.
Okay. We'll like to reach everyone. Expressway, at any rate, I'm a cigarette plug runner for, I don't know, 5-10 years. It's bad practice. I'll give you that. Bad practice, I never recommend. I have no luck. I'm running 25 watts in the team, but I'm just behind there. I have some heavy gauge, but to agree with Jim, let me drop it for a sec. Yeah, to agree, I don't think that they're cigarette lighters anymore. I think they're just accessories, and I don't think a lot of them can. They don't come with cigarette lighters, but I think you put a real one in there and you're going to blow it also. Because the newer cars are accessory ports kind of thing, like you mentioned. It's K2KEV. I'm now going aside. Going to be heading in through the tunnel, and I'll catch you on the FDR.
Yeah, very fine, Kevin. I guess it is a cigarette lighter kind of a plug, not intended really for a cigarette lighter, to run things like a charger, I guess, for a cell phone. And I guess that a cell phone charger probably only drew an amp or two, at least not huge amounts of current, whereas a mobile rig can draw 10 or 20 amps. And I think I'm using my auxiliary plug to run one of my radios in one of my cars. Seems to be working for the time being. Far from a recommended procedure. To get the wiring to go through the firewall, through that very heavy grommet, to really go back to the battery, that's quite a process. Let me ask Andy about that one. I wonder how many times, Andy, you've heard stories of people trying to install heavy amateur radio power wiring to get it through that firewall. I'll bet you there were times when to get it to work without disturbing the other equipment and to keep it all weatherproofed. That's not an easy job. Maybe most people have to hire a professional to do that. W2CDL for any comments on this one. K2RIW in the TechNet. Anybody else got any comment on how difficult it is to get the heavy gauge wiring through the firewall of a modern-day automobile, K2RAW.
VE3JIW, Jim in Toronto.
Go right ahead, Jim. Maybe on the Canadian versions of the car, they've made it easier. At least I hope that's true. You got it, Jim.
No, I think we're getting the same cars. Chevy Cruze, guy near me, went on the internet, found that the car with an automatic was still equipped with a grommet that was used for a clutch cable. The car came with a manual because it came both ways. He actually had a professional do the install for his dual band. Then he got a 7100 and he needed to double up the wires, so he copied what was there. YouTube was giving actual images of where other people had done it. A number of cars have a huge honking positive lead inside the passenger compartment. It all depends on the car, but some have a honking massive power distribution box inside the car, and others you're going to have to find a spot. And by the way, one of the hopes on finding a spot is a whole lot of cars are made in right and left hand drive, though the passenger side of North American is usually got the air conditioner put there, but there are spots when you start looking on YouTube with the cars. This was a two-year-old Chevy Cruze, and the grommet for the clutch was his, Brandon's point of entry. It is getting more difficult because the car is more modular, so that you've got a massive umbilical cord running from the engine compartment into the capacitor compartment to pick up the fuel computer and stuff. And you can't touch that umbilical cord and sneak a wire before it. So again, YouTube can give you a lot of help. And sometimes the manufacturers actually have a way, because they sell boards, for instance, sell to people who are going to put two ways in, police, fire, ambulance, well, not ambulance, but police and such are going to want the car, and they've got to find a route, and they may have it. And some cars, we talked about it here a few months ago, that the manufacturer said that the car wasn't rated for having a transceiver in it. Back KQRAW for the net, BE3JIW.
Yeah, thank you, Jim. That's interesting that there are YouTube videos, I guess, giving you further information. So by some means, we can go to YouTube and use the right search words, and they're going to tell us how to install two-way radios into automobiles and how to get the wiring for the firewall. That's what I think you're saying. It's good to know. YouTube's got some very good information on very many subjects these days. So I guess you got to choose the right search words in order to fit the right YouTube article. And do you happen to know which search words are the right ones to use, Jim? VE3JIW, K2RAW in the TechNet.
Power wiring. I think it's power wiring, because the amateur radio crowd, we might be as big as the car stereo crowd, but these car stereo guys are putting wires as thick as your pink baby finger to feed their amplifiers. And there may be as many of them out there as there are amateur radio shops. I mean, there's more shops selling huge power amps for audio than there are shops selling amateur radio transceivers. But it's power wiring, and a lot of the car stereo crowd are doing it. Plus, I remember chasing up a car stereo guy who was in a little, pile of shops, and I was out walking the aisle of a stereo shop, and I noticed they had an installation guy. I went and talked to the installation guys. These guys do amazing things with cars. You might have to make sure you have the right gauge wire, the manual for the radio, and find that you could get a car stereo installation shop to do your power wiring for your radio. And if you had, say, a 7100 or a 5100 or any of these detachable front head radios, that guy could probably open up your dash, put the head in the dash, hide all your wiring, and do, because the car stereo guys who do all sorts of amazing stuff, I mean, they put TVs and DVDs and game players and television tuners and lights underneath cars. Two-way radio install would be a piece of cake for them. Back to net.
That's good information. And thank you, Jim. And when these guys use such heavy wiring to an amplifier they're putting in a car, that suggests that they're going to really blast some pretty high-power audio in the car, which makes you worry about possible hearing damage, possible inability to hear what's going on outside the automobile, somebody beeping the horn, you'd never know it. There was a automobile accident in front of my house a few years ago where after the accident, the audio was still playing, and the audio was so loud that being half a block away, it was difficult to hold a conversation between two people that are alongside of each other. There are people who put a volume of audio inside of their car that's really crazy. I think some of our youth has damaged their hearing because of the volume of the audio they would like to have at a discotheque or at a wedding. I've been at weddings where the music being played is so loud that even though I'm half a room away, trying to talk to somebody I haven't seen for 10 years right across the table from me, and we couldn't hold a conversation without walking out of the room. Over to you for any comments on all the above, Jim. P3JIW, K2RIW in the Tech Man.
Yeah, well, a moderate car stereo amp that might have 3 100-watt RMS amps and it has like a pair of 30-amp fuses, and those car stereo amps have like 24-volt plus and minus power supplies running off 12 volts, and the amps are running off really 25 volts per channel or 50 volts for the amp. Their power requirements are way in excess of our 100-watt radio. You know, we're driving 22 amps on peaks with HF and 10 amps continuous for VHF, UHF. Yeah, if you start running a Mirage with 200 watts, you'll need some more amps. But car stereo guys put these massive capacitors in, you know, six capacitors, each one the size of a tall beer can, to give them enough power for the bass notes. And they're putting enough power to cause trunk lids to rattle on the bass notes. And, you know, you can do them. I mean, the guy, like, okay, very quickly, the guy who's running a weird little power supply to run his RMI Italian amplifier off his flex radio, and he had a massive beer can-sized capacitor to help the reduce the peak load out of the power supply for CW work. You know, that could be a whole thing on what you can now get as capacitors for your TechNet one night, the idea of super caps and what they can do. But no, car guys are running way more power than some hams are running. There's a few hams that might outdo them. Back to net.
When these car guys are using this amount of current to run audio amplifiers to give them the low notes, what is that doing to the hearing of the people inside of that car? Any opinions on that one, Jim?
Well, they're actually, some of them are doing it to compete in sound offs, and they have remote controls for the stereo, but they're not actually in the car. They're running a remote with a sound pressure meter in the car just to prove how much power they're pushing. But to realize bass notes, if you like really good music, you need more power for classical music than you need for rock, because the peaks are way, the dB range for classical is way higher. You need the bass, when you want the bass note, you need gobs of power to run it. Listening, loud volume without bass can be done with 4 or 5 watts, but you could need a couple hundred for the bass. Bass takes a lot more power just to get the sound pressure. not everybody is using it for extreme volume. My friend of mine was 300 watt amps in a box, in a bulk. Got down to 5-amp fuses to run the amp with the idea when his daughter turns up, she takes out the fuses rather than killing his batteries. But you need the power reserve to get clean power that doesn't clip. Not everybody is putting systems that are dangerous to your hearing. Shoot, Lexus was putting a Sirius amplifier in the car that played out-of-phase noise to quiet the exhaust system. But, no, if you really want clean power, you need gobs of wattage. You don't necessarily need to be trying to lift the windows out of the car. I mean, some people are doing it for that, but quality equipment is out there, and quality sound takes a lot of power to not clip.
Okay, to RY. Mr. RY, go right ahead.
Tell me something. How are you, Dick? When you're playing with these huge amplifiers and speaker systems, what are most people using for source? A source is a major part of the clarity of the sound. I guess what's most accessible to people is CD audio, but there's better audio, and there's also worse audio. Go ahead.
Part of what Jim is saying, I think, is that you're using these 100-watt amplifiers to make sure you're getting clean bass. And if the real audio you need output is, let me pick a number, 15 watts, and the amplifier is capable of 100 watts, which means you've cut back its peak capability a whole lot, you can get a tremendous increase in fidelity. If you're running a 100-watt amplifier at 100 watts, you're probably at the place where it's giving you a half or 1% total harmonic distortion. But if you're running it at a small fraction of its peak output power capability, you can get a lot cleaner audio. The distortion created by the amplifier in that case could be very small numbers. And yes, what is the source? I guess some of our digital source systems these days have got all kinds of compromises as to how the amount of audio was put onto that reporting on that recording device. Let's see if Jim's got some further comments on all of the above. VE3JIW, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, somebody keyed up just the end. They may want your attention, but I know I had a moderate amplifier, and it had two different ratings. It was Concord. It was rated 100 watts at decimal 1%, and it was rated at 60 watts at decimal 0.7% distortion. I was at an event with a DJ, and he had JBL 525 speaker amplifiers, both amplifier and speaker in the box, and it was so bad because he's taking songs and he's boosting the bass beyond belief. I mean, I think he's got electronic processors in that to boost the bass beyond what the record producer ever was trying to encode in the original song. And I went to the internet to read up on these JBL speakers. Well, the internet says these things are phenomenally good, but when you start feeding them with dirty preamps, you know, like an equalizer that's full of AM3900 little audio amplifiers for each preamp channel, you're adding noise. And anytime you add noise, the sound goes down. But these guys are overdriving their soundboard. They've got weird sound shaping, like that I think are dirty little amplifiers. There's a clipping bite on the back of the speaker that's 2%. Well, I tell you, the decimal 1% is bad. You can hear the difference between something that's the decimal 1 distortion versus decimal 0.7, you can hear the difference. So these things are clipping at 2. And you know, well, you may know that even a digital audio converter, you can get one for $5 or you can get one for several hundred dollars. So every time you add another little circuit, you add a little bit more noise. So
yeah, source is important, clean source. And anything good takes way more dollars. I mean, you could spend $350 for a little headphone amplifier where you take the digital out of your phone or iPhone or computer and you feed it into this little headphone amplifier that's got a better-than-average digital audio converter and it drives headphones, and you can spend $300 or $400 just for that. The pursuit of excellence in audio is like the mythical 1-to-1 SWR.
WB2C, UK.
Thank you, Jim. WB2C, UK, go right ahead.
Oh, you guys are talking about one of my favorite subjects besides ham radio. I have a good ear for audio. I have a collection of about 300 vinyl albums. I do have a working turntable, but it's not in service. It's in my basement and I can't get to now. And I got to tell you that that's basically the best source. It's from an analog turntable that's well-balanced and isolated from the speakers so you don't get feedback. And I'm enjoying listening to all this, these comments. I used to use something made by Southwest Technical Products called Universal Tigers. What was great about these, they had no output capacitor. They were directly driven to the speaker. And that meant you could get frequency response usually down to 20 hertz up to 20,000. And I had a lot of fun with those. And that's probably why my hearing is bad now, because I used to listen to music so loud. But 7% distortion, who was saying that? That would be intolerable. If you were listening to classical music or something with a lot of guitar playing and wooden instruments, you would really hear the cracking up for the distortion. But I'm tempted to buy a new stereo. I hear the new ones now you can control via the web and all that, so it's like a whole different world from the stuff I grew up with. Back over to you, Dick, and I want to ask you another question, but you can comment on this first.
You too, Bravo Zulu.
Bravo Zulu recognized. Bill, CUK, do you believe you can hear the difference between a 0.1% total harmonic distortion and 0.05, 0.06? Is your hearing good enough so that when you've got the direct drive to the speaker with no coupling capacitor to get the real low notes, you got to worry about any DC feed-through in that case. You could you'd be overheating the coil of your speaker if there's any DC left over when you've got direct coupling. Over to you for any comment on that, Bill. So we'd be through CUK, K2LIW.
I probably couldn't hear the difference between 0.01 and 0.1. That's pretty low. But I think 1% or 2%, you start hearing cracking up in the waveform and what sounds like harmonics. You can hear like little harmonics in there. And I've had that too. But I wanted to ask you a question. While you're continuing on this, what you know about spread spectrum communications, and if you know how it works, and if it can be applicable to hams using it. I noticed you're looking up on the web. I didn't get much information. I know there are two types, that the frequency jumps from one end to the other, and the frequency is swept from one end to the other. Well, I'm curious what you know about that, and maybe for another TechNet, we can go over that in detail.
Yeah, there's quite a number of spread spectrum techniques for getting multiple signals, lots of signals onto one particular carrier. But I'm not sure we're going to go to that immediately. Mr. Bravo Zulu, I missed your prefix, sir, and your name. Go right ahead. Give me both, K2LIW. My name is Dick.
Two, Bravo Zulu, Rich. And if anybody's ever spent time at a professional recording studio, and I mean like Columbia or, you know, the big ones, either listening to them making classical music or rock and roll or jazz, you'll know what passes for bass today. What people think is good bass is nothing like what you hear in a studio. Bass in a studio is as crisp as ever put on a guitar, and I listen to the music now, and people think the louder the boom, the better the sound, and nothing could be further than the truth. Go ahead.
K2KV with a comment.
Kevin, wait to the beeps.
Yeah, I just want to make a comment about that. I don't even think you needed a really good studio. Just good microphones, which they had back in the day, and just listen to any of the Rudy Van Gelder recordings, his Blue Note recordings. They're great, and I think it's not in the studio. It's unbelievable. I'm going to drop out now in Manhattan, K2KP.
So there are some pretty serious audio files out there concerned with total harmonic distortion, total peak envelope power, RMS versus peak power, and the quality of the original material itself. And to put all these extremely high-power amplifiers in automobiles, I worry about the fact that an error could occur when an amplifier is capable of hundreds of watts of audio, and you think most of the time you're going to use it at a lower power, but a blast from that system due to some kind of an error could do some terrible things to your hearing. There's an awful lot of our youth these days who are going to discotheques, so to speak, listening to very loud music. They want the music loud enough that they can literally feel the floor vibrate. They can feel it through their feet. And that can do some pretty serious damage to the hearing. And what's nasty about that is it doesn't occur at the time. It could be damaging your hearing. And some number of years downrange, you'll suffer the effects from that, not necessarily immediately. Anybody have any further comments on any of the above? Give me a call. That is right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Two problems. Dick, are you having a problem hearing me?
You are dropping out quite often now. Rich, we're hearing 80% of what you're saying, and then in between there's dropouts. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, I'm out on a handy talk. Vertical. Anyway, I just wanted, the last comment I wanted to make, television much closer to what you see in a studio, a TV studio now, than sound is to what you hear in a sound studio.
Okay. You're only in 50% of the time that time, and you're telling us something about television and studios and, I guess, the quality of audio. Not quite sure what the message was, Rich. W2BZ, K2RIW.
Good, Jack.
All right, go ahead, Eric.
Well, let me throw a couple numbers at you. These are sound pressure level numbers. 120 dB sound pressure level is the beginning of the pain threshold where things start to actually hurt in real time. But if you expose yourself to, say, 80, 90 dB of constant noise, you will then begin to damage the nerve endings in the cochlea. It's probably what the other guy is trying to say in terms of being in a studio. I've built a lot of studios and been involved with the rock and roll groups, and we actually go through the effort of trying to prevent them from having hearing loss, because it really doesn't take that long. What happens is that you have that kind of constant exposure, and you don't realize it. You start to make little fuck-outs in your hearing, in terms of you start to lose various different frequencies that are necessary, that are usually the harmonics, the low end. I'm going to drop. Many people today are listening to MP3s, which is a form of psychoacoustical compression. Also, these big amplifiers in the cars are usually Class D, and they're distortion mongers down at the low end, and not too bad up at the high end. In the studio, we use stuff like Genelec, some really expensive speakers, and they're matched and balanced from the bottom end where the subwoofers are, which basically we run the subwoofers. Subwoofers between like 8 hertz, so that way you've got the moving sound pressure, like in the theater, to about 30s, and some go up as high as 50, 75 hertz. To make the room shake, or to take the low end of an electric bass, or even some drums. What we do in the studio is
We're getting the raw stuff. Now, what I mean by that is that if we're talking about an analog studio, then it's purely analog from the microphone right out to the end. But in most modern studios, we digitize the audio. We take each microphone and...